everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this week's seminar in the Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Let me begin by announcing next week's seminar. We have Dr. James Laidlaw, lecturer in anthropology at the University of Cambridge and senior tutor at King's College, Cambridge, coming to give a week of lectures, and he will be next week's speaker. And he emailed me just 2 days ago to ask for a change in title. And he left the decision to me. Well, when I read the change in title, I thought the change he proposed looked very interesting indeed. So next week, James Laidlaw will be speaking about suicide in the Jain tradition, among the Jains whom he studied in India. And he will be arguing that, in fact, suicide is an important part of the ritual and religious ideology of the Jain religion. That's next week in Lecture Theatre 1. This week, the speaker is myself. I'm Paul Clough. I'm head of the anthropology program at the University of Malta. The theme of this semester's seminars is cultural understanding, or understanding cultural diversity in an increasingly plural society. And I think we've had some very stimulating papers. This week, I will be taking the theme outside of Malta and looking at research I did among Muslims in northern Nigeria. And I will be arguing that a person within the Catholic tradition is actually in a very good position to understand Islam. The paper has been brewing for many years because I used to argue with the former head of the anthropology program, Paul Sancassia, that actually being, in my own case, an ex-Catholic in a Muslim village, I felt a strange affinity. I felt that I could understand quite a bit that was going on. However, the paper was written in its original form in 2001 for a conference for a panel called Reflexive Anthropology. And this is the reason why the paper has the present style it does. And let me just say very briefly that reflexive anthropology is a new branch of social anthropology which emphasizes the need of the ethnographer to analyze their own social background, their own mental formation, and the end result is hopefully to see that what they learn about the people they're studying is the result of a strange kind of mixture of their own background and the people that they are studying. The criticism of reflexive anthropology is that, of course, it is a form of navel gazing, and the panel for which I wrote this paper could well be called a navel gazing panel. This is the first time I ever wrote about myself. I found it very difficult and frankly rather embarrassing to have to put together the paper in the form that it takes. The punchline comes near the end, and I can assure you the punchline only came after late at night after half a bottle of whiskey. Whether it is productive or not, I leave up to you to judge. The paper is called Knowledge in Passing, Reflexive Anthropology and Religious Awareness. Introduction. In this article, I outline affinities between a Roman Catholic way of thinking in which I was raised and the local Muslim shape of thought which I encountered during fieldwork. Thus, I engage with some of the recent literature on reflexivity in ethnographic practice. But I go beyond a reflexive critique of my fieldwork experience and analysis to argue that this can actually engender substantive or substantial comparisons between particular kinds of Catholicism and particular kinds of Islam. In my conclusions, I will gather together my reflections to reconsider the connection between the religious beliefs of the ethnographer and his capacity to make statements about the religion of the people whom he is studying. In Anthropology and Autobiography, Judith Oakley argues that the ethnographer must work through the specificity of the anthropologist's self in order to contextualize and transcend it. She cites approvingly J.P. Dumont's argument for a movement back and forth in ethnographic investigation between experience and self-consciousness. Narrowing her discussion to the possible forms which autobiographical analysis might take, she argues for the necessity of analyzing the ethnographer's relations with the others being studied. This paper is concerned with the ways in which the field worker's religious categories, developed from childhood through young manhood, subsequently affected his relations with the Muslim society which he studied, and more importantly, affected his analysis of the Muslim society which he studied. I stopped participating fully in Catholic belief and ritual 7 years before beginning fieldwork. Nevertheless, I argue that Catholicism established a strange familiarity with the Muslim village in northern Nigeria, where I did my fieldwork. I propose that there are strange resonances between the worlds of Roman Catholicism and Islam, which led me to sympathize with Islam at a very deep level. Childhood and youth. My experience of Catholicism was heavily affected by the age in which I grew up, the nature of the bond between my parents, and the mode of livelihood of my father. My father was an American soldier, posted every few years to a new and distant place. A cradle Catholic, his religious practice had been somewhat desultory until his experience of hell in the Second World War led him to the belief that there must be some ultimate good, or at least that we ought to search for it through prayer, examination of conscience, and the sacraments. My mother was English, but of French origin, hence Catholic. Though of very different backgrounds, they shared strong bonds of religion, humor, and mutual experience of war. I was born at a time, I will leave the date out, at a time when many men had emerged from the recent war and its anguish with the silent elation of a certain kind of religious discovery. See biographies of the period, for example, of the convert monk Thomas Merton, and of the many military men who tried monastic life. Like many service families, my parents, myself, and my two younger sisters formed an intensely close unit of affection and conversation. I think this is quite common among service families. We were our own main company. There was in me a constant division between my American and English halves. I suppose that this increased the intensity of identification with my religion. Catholic schooling and Catholic home life continuously overlapped. If I concentrate on Catholic education and its theology below, these brief remarks are meant to show that my Catholicism was historically and socially very specific. Whether we were posted in the United States or overseas, my parents sent me to Catholic schools whenever possible. In the 1950s and early 60s, this meant that I was taught by nuns. My religious consciousness was largely formed before the Second Vatican Council. The liberal shift produced by the Council, from the fear of God to his love, increased my personal interest in Catholic thought. My first 2 years of high school were at a Catholic boys' school in Ohio, taught by articulate young male religious. My last 2 years were at a state school. I was an undergraduate in England. I studied philosophy, politics, and economics. The skeptical and linguistic nature of English philosophy in the mid and late 1960s led me to an agnostic doubt in the existence of God. At the time, much English philosophy was empiricist. The empiricism continuously taught to me and thought between the ages of 18 and 20 have been one of the strongest mental influences of which I am conscious. Thus, my new doubt led me to a particular interest in moral philosophy, but with a metaphysical purpose. If God was not logically self-evident, perhaps he might be found empirically, through the inspection of moral worry. I read existentialist Christian theology. Paul Tillich's unconditional demand, its content might vary from culture to culture, was for me a persuasive translation of Kant's categorical imperative. Nigeria. Soon after leaving university, I went to teach in Ahmadu Bello University in northern Nigeria. It was the 1970s. I was stimulated by the debates over the relevance of Marxist political economy. The focus of my interest shifted from Catholicism to Marxism, which, as you know, is a very well-known trajectory from one totalizing set of beliefs and assumptions to another. I decided to begin postgraduate studies after some years, 6 years teaching in northern Nigeria, based on fieldwork in the rural Hausa-speaking society of northern Nigeria. My research would be on the linkages between rural and urban economies, and more especially the rural trading networks emanating from the Hausa village in which I lived. In 1977, I went to live in Marmara village for 2 years of fieldwork. And I just want to show you a few photographs of Marmara village to give you an idea and make this less abstract. There's the main road to the village. There's a cemented mosque in the background. The mango tree in the middle of the village. Here again. This picture is taken from a recent visit in 1998. You see the poor quality of the main road, but at the same time you see that they do have recently installed electricity. There is the mud compound opposite the mango tree on the main road where I lived, the warehouse of the village's main trader. And there he is, and I will call him M in this paper. And now some pictures of family life. Here is the former hamlet head, an old man. You can see in the picture three of his wives, the oldest being in the middle, and below his third married son, with one, two, three of his wives and many children and seven brothers. Here is a picture of a much younger man who happens to have around 4 acres of land with three wives and, well, I always lose count of the number of children in these photographs. And here we have another picture of the village praise singer, taken in 1998 with his younger brother, with his one wife and numerous children. Notice the emphasis. It's not my emphasis. It's what happens when you take photographs in a village. The family life, a polygynous society, the number of wives, the large number of children. Here we find girls in the village, unmarried girls, selling cooked snacks. And you'll notice that some of them have the Muslim a modified version of the Muslim chador, but others do not. In that respect, Hausa society has a quite flexible Islam. And lastly, just a photo sketch of some faces of men from about the age of 40 downwards to boys, which I took in 1998. I had finished undergraduate studies in 1969 and stopped calling myself a Catholic around 1970. Thus, 7 years separated full-time fieldwork from active participation in the Catholic Church. While living in Marmara, I never thought of my Catholic background when puzzling over my encounters with people, nor do I remember thinking of Catholicism while listening to their accounts of Muslim belief or observing their religious rituals. But then the focus of my inquiry and my analysis was on the nature of their economic life. The fact that I was living among the people whom I was studying meant that I was continually in social experiences which forced me to contextualize their economic practices. I was collecting conversations which bore upon their beliefs. Unlike discussions in which I was seeking out specific economic information, these conversations inevitably involved a heavy element of accident. They were usually unsolicited conversations. I would argue that my focus on economic life meant that there was an unguided quality to my dialogues with villagers on religious questions, and that this was a good thing. At this point, I wish to propose two underlying generalizations. First, the period of writing the dissertation back in England and later in Malta was a part of fieldwork in a very important way. I mean to say that, bewildered by old and familiar surroundings, I was not just taxing my original hypotheses about rural economy with numerical evidence, but more deeply, I was making an effort to recall to mind all whom I had known and what they had expressed with force. In the process, I invoked and developed what Peter Leinhardt called the field worker's sense of the community in which he had lived. In analyzing my field notes and memories, my process of interpretation began to revolve around certain images. Secondly, any reflexive critique of ethnographic analysis must try to account for memory and take a position on the way that memory works. When writing my dissertation, I was seeking to explain my economic evidence in terms of the totality of interrelationships, an interpretation of villagers' mentality in a unified way. In moving towards a totalizing interpretation of a world religion in a local context, how was I remembering? In what ways was my remembering selective? This is an issue which you will see running through the paper. At this remove from the dissertation, I am, of course, remembering the way in which I remembered. Below, I discuss just some of the forceful images from fieldwork in my memory, which I remember as being constantly invoked in the process of analysis and writing. In part one, I will comment on the extent to which my memories were influenced by my previous Catholicism. In part two, I will discuss the extent to which my arrangement of memories amounted to a Catholic interpretation of one Muslim society. Part one, Memories of Islam. The death of Al-Hajj Ibrahim. Less than a month after starting fieldwork, my work with a villager was interrupted by the unusual sound of women's high cries. We could see that they were coming from the house of Al-Hajj Ibrahim, and very quickly knew that his long illness was over. Soon thereafter, I found myself, despite myself, entering the inner compound of Al-Hajj Ibrahim, where his body was being wrapped. A large number of male and female kin were gathered, and in such shock that nobody remarked on my being there, although I was not close to Al-Hajj and would not normally have gone in without an invitation. Then his senior male relative, Al-Hajj Lawai, arrived. A huge, physically active man, Al-Hajj Lawai was normally quiet and reserved. On this occasion, he burst into tears, fell in front of the body, and began talking to it. He kept on asking God's forgiveness for questioning his will, but repeatedly moaned, "Ibrahim, Ibrahim, I will miss you." Youth, my youth. Al-Hajj Lawai's public breaking of the wall around self-disclosure affected me deeply, but his open and naggingly repetitive expression of guilt at not accepting God's will was understandable, even reasonable to me. As a Catholic, I had spent my young mental life worrying about the continuous disjunction between what I did and what was permissible according to God's law. In responding, in remembering this incident, it was the anxiety in Al-Hajj Lawai's voice that struck such a responsive chord. The final prayers for Al-Hajj Ibrahim. Once the body was cleaned and wrapped in a white cloth for burial, all of the household heads in the village gathered in complete silence in front of the house of Al-Hajj Ibrahim. Compressing that moment with the evening after, I remember a sense of the dramatic hiatus between life before Al-Hajj's death and now the moments after. Although his death was expected by many, he was one of the wealthiest farmers with one of the largest families, and people would comment favorably on his treatment of poorer men. The man for whom they gathered to pray was very personally known. In writing my dissertation, I often had the memory of men silently assembling. They took off their shoes and left them by the wall of the house. Very informally, they stood in lines, with only the laman in front, facing east, heads bowed and hands raised with palms frontward. They quietly, collectively intoned, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, God is great. They repeated this several times in a hushed way. Then they found and put on their shoes, their poor little plastic shoes, and one by one they left. I found myself often referring to this memory when thinking over my evidence. It conjured up a place in which prayer was public, and in prayer, great differences between men and wealth or influence were rendered non-existent. The wrenching experience of a death was redefined by the prayer as being unimportant in the face of God. An occasion of many individual thoughts or griefs was transformed into the expression of an infinitely more important reality. There is a creator of flesh who remains after each sentient creation is corrupted. In my memory, there seemed to be a logical movement in the simplicity of the ritual. Despite individual ideas or feelings, one idea can be apprehended and expressed collectively. The Creator is. This idea led to an impression in my memory. Apart from and beyond quotidian interactions, there is a community created by adherence to this transcendental idea. The community of believers, the house of God, Dar al-Islam, emerges from, but is different from, the other quotidian community. Youth. The religious education in Catholic high school encouraged us to continuously refine our idea of an abstraction, an invisible creator who, while infinitely different from human beings, was knowable to them. Human thought, feeling, and action in all their sensuous particularity were given a meaning by the pre-existence of undifferentiated spirit. Articulate school texts and teachers reiterated the basic idea that divisible materialities drew their existence and their explanation from indivisible spirit. Worries about the divine law and the fear of God. Muslims in Marmara worried about divine law. Once, when I was measuring the farmland of the village, with the help of a villager, we came across his father walking along the road. He had been to see one of the malams to ask whether or not a certain act was forbidden, haram. He talked to us with feeling about the malam's reply. This chance meeting left a memory, which I often used when, in writing my dissertation, I sought to generally typify the moral consciousness of villagers. My research led me out of the village in long-distance journeys to marketplaces where the village trader, M, sold his produce. There I was investigating techniques of profit-making. I would ask a village friend, for explanations of information which confused me. Once he was explaining a fairly standard trading practice, the removal by the long-distance trader of several measures of grain from each sack without declaring this to the retailers to whom he sold his produce. The haunting point for me was that, and this didn't get into my dissertation, at the end of his explanation of M's trading practice, and this was late at night in the hush of darkness, my friend paused and then said to me quietly and very carefully, M no longer does this because as he gets older, he fears going to hell. At the time of fieldwork, I was inclined to see the situation as a striking example of pre-modern belief inflecting decisions by economic actors in an otherwise quite sophisticated market economy. For a recent statement, see John and Jean Komaroff in Modernity and Its Malcontents. During the period of writing, I saw things differently. When I was in the process of analyzing my findings and writing up the dissertation,
I saw an active theological world being constituted by the relationship between ordinary people and the public or private counseling of Quranic malams. In that world, God in some sense constitutes moral law. The knowing infraction of this law necessarily breaks the individual's relationship with God. Youth. Worries about divine law and fears of the divine were a constant experience of childhood and youth. I have a memory of the first time that I memorized the differences between mortal and venial sin from the Baltimore Catechism, the standard medium of American Catholic instruction in the period before Vatican II. Thereafter, until I stopped going to Mass and calling myself a Catholic around the age of 21, I was grounded in a feeling of transgression. All actions could be characterized in terms of their moral content, and if wrong, were mortally or venially so. If seriously wrong, the question of culpability turned or whether or not the doer acted with full knowledge and full consent. The private examination of conscience required quasi-public expression through the confessional, where transgressions were admitted in secrecy in a small, semi-enclosed box to an ecclesiastical official. But since we were taught that the priest absolver had the full power of God, confession was really a triangular encounter between sinner, priest, and God. The world of codification and transgression which I inhabited was also a strange multiple world. And I take this idea again from John and Jean Komaroff's book, Modernity and Its Malcontents. A supernatural judge existed behind the world of appearances. Behind the curtains also lay three other worlds, heaven, purgatory, and hell. These were realities as real as the world of the five senses. Living with these supernatural realities, my fear was constant. Nevertheless, there was another dimension to these beliefs. Whatever pain they caused me, they imbued the physical world with a quality of the holy other, which gave it added significance and luster. Living in a ritual community. During fieldwork, I was surrounded by mosques, the sound of calls to prayer, and the sight of men gathering five times a day to pray in unison. These experiences gave physical form to my days. Men would frequently gather in small groups to listen to preaching or commentary on the Quran. I never felt any sense of strangeness at living amid these rituals. Youth. These small observations can be related to that other aspect of my Catholic upbringing. It was a combination of schooling and ritual. We would sometimes leave classes to attend Mass as a whole school. Schooltime masses were occasioned by some national tragedy, for example, the murder of a president, or by the call to listen to a special sermon by the parish monsignor, or in high school, the school moral advisor. The physical circumstances inscribed a certain kind of drama and an aesthetic. The vaulted nave, the solid columns of stone, the visual focus on the high altar, the priest speaking from above and in front, the fact that much of the time we would be in an unusual posture, kneeling. Kneeling marked a sacred departure from mundane posture. The intended emphasis was on the humility of the postulant before a master. In retrospect, the collective movement from standing to kneeling to sitting and back again seems to be not far removed from the physical form of Muslim prayer, alternately standing, bowing, kneeling, and sitting. Self-reflection and moral reasoning. The longer I was in Marmara, the more I became aware of the proneness of men to self-reflection. Clifford Geertz mentions a very, very similar experience, a very similar propensity among the Muslim villagers of Java. And I quote, "There was an astonishing intellectual vitality, a philosophical passion, really, Destitute peasants would discuss questions of freedom of the will. Illiterate tradesmen discoursed on the properties of God. Common laborers had theories about the relations between reason and passion. The problem of the self was pursued with a sort of reflective intensity. That's from Clifford Geertz, Local Knowledge, 1983. In the quiet of my room, Medwin insists on a specific course of action, using the word gara, with the meaning you really should, or dole, with the sense of compulsory. They would compare each other's economic success in terms of hali. Hausa dictionaries translating hali generally as character, temperament, disposition, mode, or even just peculiarity. But the lexical examples in the dictionaries all point to contrasts between good and bad, spiritual and physical, courageous and cowardly, liberal and mean. In Maramara, there was certainly an emphatic quality to the explanation of other people's behavior in terms of good or bad hali. My experience of the Hausa language was that people reserved their highest approval for those who undertook hidama. Dictionaries translate this simply as serving a person, but in Marmara it seemed to have the special connotation of responsibility and was used of a range of responsibilities, especially the responsibility to provide oneself and one's children with marriage partners. And as the photographs suggest or indicate, the basis of the society in polygyny meant that as a man's income increased, he had much greater responsibilities. He was not only taking more wives for himself, with the added children involved, but he was also trying to find wives for his sons and husbands for his daughters. Villagers were obsessed by the rightness or wrongness of the ruling class. They would say, what the rulers do is unlawful, haram, by the Muslim code. Or they would say with great force, we hate tyranny. While I have written in the past that this was an ethnographic experience, I would now argue that my tendency to fasten on the moral inflections of rural Hausa discourse was mediated by prior experience in the Catholic Church. Youth. I was trained by nuns and male religious to carefully examine my conscience before confession. Private self-examination was thus tied to the act of penance. The confessional combined intimate privacy with a strangely public affirmation. For the only other person listening, a priestly confessor, seemed as present and loud as the voice of God. The act of self-examination preceding this public stroke private affirmation of moral treason was intensely individual. It was I who had to probe myself, and I who had to state my wrongs. In self-examination, the concept of free will achieved a searing reality. Since we were taught that the sin was always propelled by the individual sinner, that its wrongness derived as much from its being entirely caused by the mental decision of the actor as by its internal etiology, the sense of wrongdoing was inextricably entangled with a sense of individual freedom of choice. I probed my conscience to confirm what I had intended to do in full consent. To believe this was necessarily to throw oneself on external mercy. The drama of salvation was the alternation between acts for which I was wholly responsible and the forgiver. The ritual of penance combined with Catholic theology to constitute a very particular sense of self, of free will, and therefore of culpability. The kind of introspection developed in a Catholic youth established, I would argue, an affinity with the introspectiveness I found in my villagers. Based on my mediated experience of Hausa Muslims, however, I would argue that the difference in their kind of introspection and my own can be overstressed. At the time of fieldwork, I felt that a profound fatalism pervaded their belief that the will or power of God, Ikwan Allah, decreed the success or failure, life and death of every person. It seemed to add to the detachment with which they could discuss the fortune or misfortune of others. While believing in hard work and the naturalness of ambition, the outcome of all efforts was in the hands of God. This is very different from Catholic teaching. Nevertheless, in reflecting on fieldwork, I came to believe that Muslim villagers did have a sense of agency. It focused on moral culpability. The site of personal responsibility was intention and attitude to others. Intention constituted the domain of personal choice, even if the effects in the world of all choices were determined by God. Thus, it was possible for them both to believe in the defined determination of effects and to approve or disapprove of the character of others. Part two, a Catholic typification of the Muslim community. My dissertation was preceded by an extremely detailed analysis of the economic evidence I had collected. In the actual writing of it, I tried to sustain a complex argument through each of the chapters, covering different spheres of economic life, pointing repeatedly to the big inequalities in landholding among villagers, in the advanced commoditization of land, labor, and produce. I nevertheless argued that rural society was not polarizing into classes. And let me just show you a few photographs to make the discussion less abstract. Largest farmer in the village. You notice him with his car, his pickup truck, his tractor, various sons behind who were managers of his labor force. He had over 300 acres of land. Here is an ordinary villager planting corn. A man with about 3 acres of land. In here we see the same man's field being plowed by oxen and metal plow. The accumulation of capital served but was constrained by the accumulation of family members and the accumulation of clients and friends. The dense interconnections between these three forms of accumulation, capital, family, and clients' friends, constituted a complex non-capitalist pattern of accumulation in my argument. In consequence, relations between rich and poor were continuously reconfirmed through marriage as well as through clientage. There were significant opportunities for upward economic mobility. These conclusions appeared to be based on an analysis of Hausa economic life. Nevertheless, my introduction singled out polygyny as the central feature of social life. Polygyny gave strategic purpose to all economic endeavors. As men's income increased, they took on additional wives. A significant proportion of money profit was channeled into their own marriages and those of their maturing children. And here I read from my thesis. The thinking of both sexes was dominated by the social prestige of polygynous marriage. Incorrigibly, a man with one wife sought a second, and if he had the income, a third. Polygyny must also be seen from the woman's perspective. Almost 70% of the wives of household heads had co-wives because polygyny was more common than monogamy. I also tied my stress in the thesis on accumulation to an emphasis on the understanding of local ethical beliefs. The unity of any culture consisted in the ways in which its particular trajectory of accumulation was grounded in a unity of moral value. So you can see that Paul Tillich's unconditional demand had resurfaced from my earlier Catholic life. I was linking accumulation, polygyny, and moral value. But the third element in this triad, the shared nature of moral values, was at least as much my own assumption as it was an ethnographic experience. This tendency to think of my village as shot through with spiritual insight has, I think, influenced me to see forces of integration where others on the same evidence might see a process of polarization. In retrospect, the account of Islam in Maramara contained in my dissertation is really an account of society as church. And here I will just read a rather long passage from the dissertation. This comes from the past. Here I can only sketch the contours of their culture to alert the reader to those features of social life which were so compelling as to influence my whole analysis. People were keenly conscious of new kinds of division and integration. Their economic differences in the past, when they had been pagans, had derived mainly from the number of wives and children a man could deploy in farming. After conversion as Muslims, they saw themselves as bifurcated between a small number of rich villagers who combined farming with trade and ordinary farmers who were dependent on the rich for credit. At the same time, they saw themselves as constituting a new kind of community, much larger and more abstract than before conversion. They were now part of the Jama'ah, the people of God. The Jama'ah have repented, Tuba, and in consequence they continuously beseech or beg God, Ruku Allah. Islam in Marmara was collective and self-conscious. It gave detailed form to the day, week, and year. All men gathered five times a day for prayer in one of the earthen mosques. On Friday, they traveled to the mosque in the town for the early afternoon prayer of Azahar. All adults fasted during Ramadan. All boys gathered in front of the houses of various malams for several years of instruction in the Quran. Men would frequently gather in small groups to listen to preaching or commentary on the Quran. Then again, there were special gatherings, very strange, at which men and women shouted incoherently their sense of the presence of God. Older boys often spent several years as begging Quranic students in faraway places. When infants were given their Muslim names, most of the settlement would gather for the prayers at the ceremony. Men would travel miles to attend the naming ceremony of a friend's child. Naming celebrated induction into the Jama'ah. It thus symbolized religious unity in a way that marriage ceremonies did not. And I want to show you some photographs of the naming ceremony ritual. There is another village praise singer. And besides singing people's praises at marriage ceremonies, they often acted as leaders of prayer at naming ceremony. These take place in the early morning. And here you see him at the moment, just before they shafa patia. That's where they cover their faces with their hands in prayer when the name of the child is read out by the liman of the village. And you see the villagers gathered around, village men. Here we see on our right grandfather
of the newly born child being named. And you see an interesting group of villagers. Here you see a very rich farmer, here a very poor one. Here you see the Zaman himself, another poor villager. Here you see the most learned Malam, the Metasiri, who really understood Arabic and was properly able to comment on the various books of jurisprudence. And here another ordinary villager.
How can you see whether they're rich or poor because of their size?
I know, and I'm telling you, you can't tell is the point I'm trying to make, really. That is, in fact, the point which I'm trying to make through the photographs rather than through my text. You find that the ritual brings together rich and poor, higgledy-piggledy, all united by the prayer, you see. And the Muslim prayer has this extremely simple, elemental quality to it, which I mentioned when I talked about the funeral ceremony. And here's another picture taken from the same morning naming ceremony. And again, you have villagers rich and poor, and there in the middle, wearing a woolen cap, it was a day in the cold, dry season, a morning, is the same man whose picture with car and tractor and pickup truck you saw, the richest and largest farmer in the village, was over 300 acres. But in these ceremonies, of course, rich and poor are really quite indistinguishable.